Welcome to Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, hosted by Dr. Ryan Mauley and Travis Buzzell. Join us on this journey as we educate the patient population, inform today's medical providers, and inspire tomorrow's medical leaders through education and in-depth discussion. We can all discover today's best healthcare solutions. Now, sit back and enjoy Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions, Private Practice Podcasters.
Hey everybody, Dr. Ryan Mauley here for another episode of Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions Private Practice Podcasters with my co-host,
Travis Buzzell.
So we had a little bit of time off, you know, the early summer. I had a couple week vacation, but really excited to kind of be back at it with you, Trav.
Yeah, believe it or not, I've been golfing a lot, so.
A lot more than I've been golfing. But that being said, you know, super excited about tonight's guest. Yeah. I actually had the opportunity and pleasure to meet one of his partners about a month ago when I was out in Chicago at the Becker's ASC Spine and Orthopedic Conference. And he mentioned our guest's name. I said, wait a second, he's going to be on our podcast here. And thank you, Dr. Aluzio, for being flexible to allow us to reschedule this, because we did have this scheduled earlier. But without further ado, Dr. Frank Aluzio, orthopedic surgeon.
Welcome, Doc.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on here to talk about topics that are near and dear to all of our hearts about keeping independent practices alive and thriving. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, no, thanks for taking the time to join us. And so, I mean, just to give the viewers and, you know, everyone that tunes into, you know, the podcast. So can you give us sort of the 10,000 foot view of Dr. Aluzio? You know,
why did we get caught up? I always say 30,000 foot view. You say 10,000 foot view.
Yeah, I think 30,000 foot is a little bit too high. I don't know. I like to get a little closer.
It's like a bigger picture. You can see more.
How about 20,000? Can you compromise? I don't know. He's not a big compromise guy. So 30,000 foot view of kind of, you know, who you are, where you're from, where you went to school, you know, orthopedic, like how did all this kind of come to be?
Yeah, where did you get your inspiration for orthopedics? And then obviously the private practice thing is going to be like the bulk of this.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I was born and raised in New Hyde Park, New York, which is on Long Island, and went to college and med school down at Emory University in Atlanta. Big change from growing up in New York, but now there's not too much of a difference between the two areas. Went to residency, did my orthopedic residency at Duke, and then did a fellowship in the Otto O. Frank Adult Reconstruction Fellowship in hip and knee replacement in Boston back in 1997. Came to Greensboro, North Carolina in 1998, and I've had a hip and knee practice since. So when I started, we had our group in Greensboro Orthopedics is about 14 people. And, we had extremely devoted to maintaining independence, but we saw as time went on that it was going to be harder and harder to do so. So starting about 2014, several of the large independent practices in North Carolina got together and said, we should all come together and join a single practice, utilizing our size and leverage to maintain our independence. So in 2016, Emerge Ortho formed. Initially, it was four regions. It was the group out of Wilmington at the coast, and Triangle Orthopedics, which is in Raleigh-Durham. Then Foothills area, which is around the Hickory, Statesville area. And another group in Asheville, North Carolina. Our group in Greensboro didn't come in initially because we were going to come in as one large community, and we weren't quite ready. So in 2019, we came in. Now it's five main regions of the state, and us in Ortho Carolina form the two largest groups in North Carolina. That's wow. That was the genesis of Emerge Ortho.
Wow. So I guess first question obvious is like, okay, you're an independent guy. I'm an independent guy. Private practice is kind of the meat and potatoes for who we are, what we do. But What was it in 2014 that this coalition of orthopedic surgeons started talking? Like, I know reimbursements have been declining for decades now. Was it that? Was it, did you start to see the pendulum shift of a lot of these younger guys are going into hospital employment? What was the main impetus for these conversations to be started?
You know, we saw the writing on the wall that, just like you said, the reimbursement was starting to go down. The regulation and the regulatory burden was just starting to tick up around then. That's when EMR was coming into place. And we knew our practice expenses were going to get a lot more. And we saw migration towards younger people coming out of residency and going into hospital-based positions and said, we're not going to be able to compete in 5 to 10 years unless we get larger. It was basically a go big or go home situation. And fortunately, in each of the groups, we had people that trained together and knew each other and trusted each other. And these were all high quality groups and very like-minded. And we said, well, let's explore. Let's see what it's going to take for all of us to get together. And I think the only way we're going to be able to maintain independence is if we do something like this. And fortunately, it's proved to be true, and it's proved to be a very fruitful relationship. It is the group is thriving now.
What's your head count? Like, how many surgeons? How many mid levels? How many total employees?
So we have 160 physicians altogether, 120 orthopedic surgeons, and we have family practice sports, pain management, both anesthesia and physiatry. One of the groups even has a couple of general surgeons that they had as part of their group before they had come in to emerge. Have close to 200 mid-levels and over 200 physical therapists.
Wow. Wow.
Altogether, and 2,200 employees and 60 locations throughout the state.
So do you know, like, all of, and I'm sure not all of you are partners. I mean, I'm sure there's employed physicians and there's partners and different levels of partnership, but do you know the names of all of the physicians in your practice?
I pretty much, yeah. Well, as president, I've got to know most of them. So the people that have come in within, prior to the past 2 years that are not that are partners now that are not still employed and they're on a partnership track. I'd say I'd know 90-95% of them.
Okay.
And the ones that are coming on the partnership, I'll know all of them as soon as they become partners.
Wow. I mean, that just sounds like the perfect storm, right? I mean, because all those pieces all have to kind of mesh together in order for that kind of conglomerate to kind of come to become what Emerge Ortho is today, right? I mean, for me, that's incredible.
Yeah, we actually brought in 20 new physicians in the calendar year. Well, from April of 23 to April of 24, we hired 20 new physicians.
So to me, and I'm just in awe right now because I have a private practice, but it's tiny. So I'm the owner and I have 4 physicians that are employed and I have 5 mid-levels that are employed. It's tiny, started out just adult reconstruction, myself and one of my colleagues who did the same fellowship as me. We trained with Adolf Lombardi I train with Keith Barron as well, but
Keith's my good buddy.
Yeah, I was gonna say the fellow Dukies, right? Like you guys stick together, and so you and his brother and Bolognese and all those guys, right?
Yeah, Mike and I, his brother Mike and I, were a year apart.
Okay, I was gonna ask like where you guys were at because Keith's a little bit younger than you, right?
I think he started the year after I finished.
Okay, but you to have 160. Is that what you said, physicians?
160 physicians.
120 of which are surgeons?
Yes.
It's got to be a lot of checking the egos at the door, right? Like, I don't want to get into the challenges right out of the gates, but to get that many people together from 5 different groups that want to agree upon, like, this is our new group, and you have to have some type of standardization, right? And everybody's going to think that their way is the best way. How do you even, like, start? Seems daunting to me.
Those are some of the biggest challenges, I think, anytime you start a large practice like that, cultural, you got to make sure you're all of the same mindset, that all the groups are yeah, very similar philosophies. And fortunately, you know, we all did. The other big issue with coming together is governance. So we had outside counsel come and tell us what would be the best mechanism for governance. And what we did is there are three representatives from each region on our executive committee. So pretty much all of the financial and other decisions that we make come through the executive committee. And these are all elected by each of the regions. So the partners are entrusting the people on the executive committee to make the right decisions. And then we share all the decisions back home with the, each respective region. And once a year, we get together and have all physician meetings, shareholders and non-shareholders come together. And we basically go over everything we've done. And the whole key to this is, though, checking egos at the door is communication. As long as you communicate and tell people what you're thinking about doing and go over the pros and cons of everything, then people generally tend to be on board with it. And it's a whole lot easier if we're successful. If we have, you know, down years or down quarters, then the ability to maintain it all, it gets a lot harder. That's when people start questioning stuff.
So I guess one of my questions, so just in terms of like perspective, so I think you said, so this kind of conglomerate comes together, and you said in 2014? 2016.
Okay. 14 is when the conversation started, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
So
the doors opened August 1st, 2016.
My wedding anniversary. Look at that. Except not 2016, but close, 2015. So as the group comes together, like, so I'm assuming the 160 and 120 surgeons, like, what was that number then, if you can remember, and how much has it grown since 2016?
Yeah, I can't remember exact numbers because our region in Greensboro, we didn't come until January of 19.
Okay.
So I would say it was probably, shareholders initially, probably about 55 or 60 initially. We came in at about 15, and we're growing. Shareholders now, we're about 97. So 97 out of the 160 are partners.
Yeah. So it's grown. I mean, quite significantly,
yeah,
since then.
It has grown, especially the past 2-3 years. It's been pretty exponential growth. And we added another existing practice from the beach area this January.
So do you have 6 regions now?
No, it's 5 regions. And there are, I think, 8 physicians in that group. And they came in to the coastal region, which is our Wilmington area.
Got it. So you've got, how many offices do you guys have across 60. The state of 60?
60. Yeah.
Oh. And so are all of those like physician offices seeing patients, or some of those physical therapy offices, some of the, like, what's the breakdown of the locations?
Well, each of the regions has a main office and a minimum of 2 or 3 satellites. And one of our regions, the Triangle in the Raleigh-Durham area, they have multiple different sites, and what they do is when they open a new site, it'll start out as PT and orthopedic urgent care, and if it becomes busy enough, then they'll have surgeons out there also, but some of the regions have physician's assistants do the orthopedic urgent care, some have physicians do it, and some have a combination. But most of the new offices we're opening are combos of the urgent care and PT.
So with urgent care, I mean, you're getting lumps, bumps, lacerations, things like that. Mm-hmm. Do you guys turn anything away or have like restrictions on this? We don't see this?
I think if it's something, open fracture or something that obviously needs to go to an emergency room.
But it's all orthopedics, correct?
Oh, it's all, I'm sorry. All okay. Orthopedics, yeah.
Yep. You're not coming in with a chronic cough or, fever of unknown origin or anything like that. It's ortho, musculoskeletal stuff.
Exactly.
Okay. Do you, ASCs, what's your percentage of procedures as a whole that you guys do in ASCs versus community hospitals versus any other facilities?
It kind of varies by the regions based on the availability of the ASCs. In North Carolina, a year ago, the state finally passed CON reform. So starting November of 25, we'll be able to open our own ASCs.
And it will not be a CON state anymore, or?
No, no, it's going. CON's going away for ASCs. Oh, November nice. 25. So one of the regions has their own, the Triangle area in Raleigh-Durham have their own hospital and their own ASC. And
physician-owned hospital?
Yeah.
Nice.
Came in before the
moratorium.
Affordable Care Act. So they were grandfathered then.
I'm fortunate enough to be part of that too.
That's great.
Yeah, Edgewood Surgical Hospital. So everybody always calls it an ASC. I'm like, it's not an ASC. We have 10 inpatient beds. We can keep people overnight. And the reimbursement rates are much higher for...
Right, since it's got the hospital designation.
Yeah.
So we have two ASCs, one there and one in Wilmington, that are solely owned by the... that are solely orthopedic and owned by the eMERGE physicians in those regions. And then we have some joint ventures throughout the rest of the state. So I would say as far as percentages... probably about, it depends on the procedure, but I would say over 50% is an ASC. Our region in Greensboro, we started outpatient joint program in 2017. Our community probably does about 3,000, 3,500 joints a year. Now, over 50% of them are done in the ASC, which is a joint venture with SCA. It's not a joint venture with the hospital.
Okay. So it sounds like from what you were saying just a couple minutes ago is that each region, like one region you mentioned in particular, had their own, a couple ASCs. They're owned by that particular region's physicians, not yes. eMERGE Ortho as a whole.
Yeah, you have to do that.
Yeah.
As well as safe harbor stuff, and you really can't have ownership if you're not going to utilize it.
Correct. Okay. Makes sense.
So I guess... one of the things getting away from the business side of things, but as you were kind of giving us the 30,000 foot view, I was thinking about,
why are you doing air quotes?
Guy from New York is doing his fellowship in Boston. How was that?
It was a great year. I absolutely loved it. It was, except the winter. The winter was not fun.
I saw that.
Since I had been down, I was down south for 14 years before I went up there for that one winter in Boston.
Did you become a Sox fan during that year?
Yeah, I mean, I went to a couple of games.
Fenway's cool, games. Right?
Fenway's amazing.
Fenway's the best.
Well, I loved Boston. The people were awesome up there.
Cool.
And it was it gave you a whole new appreciation for the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry.
Well, I'm a big Red Sox guy, and so people that are obviously aren't going to see this, but before we started the podcast, Doc, when we were talking, I said, you know, who's the jersey behind you? And he says Jeter. And I'm like, oh, here we go. So it's kind of funny to hear, you know, the fellowship side of things. It's like, you know, the Yankee guys up in Beantown trying to, muster his way through trying to watch some of these games. But no, it is. It's amazing. I was there. God, I can't remember what year it was when A-Rod was still there and he got hit. And it was a big thing and the bench is clear. And it's a fun rivalry to watch. So I think that's kind of cool from your perspective to be a New York guy, but be able to be up there during that time and watch baseball. So that's fun.
Yeah, I was up there in 97, summer 97 up until July 98. So Yankees were just starting to get a lot better then. Yeah. Boston was, they were down at that point.
Yeah. A lot of those guys had left. we lost a couple bats. So
I mean, I feel like Jeter was just coming around right around then, right? Or was he a couple years after that?
He was a few years in.
Yeah.
I think he was around 95 when he started.
Okay. Yeah.
The legend of the captain was just beginning at that time.
Oh my gosh, what a great series!
Yeah. No, he's.
I took my. I do a trip each year with. We have three boys, my wife and I, and each year I do a trip with all three of them, but individually. And they get to pick the city, and it's always a sports event. And my oldest son loves the Celtics. So it was a good year for him, but we went up. Great. We went to the Garden this year. We got to see them, and they played the Mavericks, which was pretty cool because it was the finals. And yep. A little finals preview. And, you know, just a great city up there. I mean, we walked everywhere from dinner. We went to the old Cheers bar for lunch one time. You know, we got to walk to the garden. We went to Fenway and we got to check it out. I mean, there wasn't any games going on because this was back in the, you know, I think February or March, but we at least got to get a tour of the park.
I think you sent me a picture and I was looking at it and I was like, is that Mark Cuban?
Yeah, he got to meet Mark Cuban down on the...
you know, he was up at the game.
On this, yeah, yep. Really nice guy, too. I mean, my son just went down and was like... he didn't have any clue who he was. I said, that's Mark Cuban. He's like, oh, should I go talk to him? I'm like, go for it.
Might not be a horrible idea.
Why not?
Yeah.
So, Doc, this might be kind of a boring question, but I'm always kind of curious because as people sort of, I guess, cross paths where places I've lived. So when my background, Med Device, I own our own distributorship here locally now, a consulting company. But when I first started in my Med Device career from Erie, Pennsylvania, when I graduated, I moved to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and then ended up moving to Gwinnett County. So Emory was a big call pattern for me when I'm talking to, you know, different trauma hospitals about cervical collars and, you know, just different things that I used to deal with. So, I mean, Emory obviously is, you know, a great school. It's got a great reputation. What, like, how did you, was that like your number one pick? Is that where you wanted to go? I mean, how did you end up from, I mean, New York, where there are obviously, you know, a lot of options at Emory? Was that always kind of like the goal, or how did that come about?
No. No, interestingly, I was the first one in my family to go to college, so we really had no clue. And I had a guidance counselor in high school, and I knew I wanted to go into medicine. And she said, well, are you absolutely dead set on staying in New York? I was like, no. I mean, I'll leave my options open anywhere. She said, well, there's a school down in Atlanta. I said, well, that's pretty far. She said, yeah, but she said, there are lots of people there from tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and they've got a great pre-med program. I said, okay, I'll take a look at it. So the interesting thing is I applied like right at the deadline, sight unseen, and got in, and my family was like, all right, I think you're going to be more successful if you get out of this environment and try something different. So sight unseen, I said yes, and showed up there in August for orientation and absolutely loved the place.
Yeah.
Absolutely loved it.
What about ortho? Like, when did you decide? Because we all have our story. We all have that person or light bulb or event that happened in our life, whether it was an injury, whether it was, for me, I was always very good with my hands, carpenter. What was it for you and when?
So, I mean, I always knew I wanted to be a physician, you know, from probably back in middle school to high school. But didn't have much exposure to medicine at all. Like I said, we didn't have anyone in the family that even had gone to college. But I played a lot of sports, never had, you know, luckily, knock on wood, never had any major injuries, but a lot of minor injuries. Got to, you know, see orthopedists. And also, it's similar to you. Love to work with my hands, love to do carpentry work. And I was like, you know, well, what a great combination. Could still be involved in all the sports world and get to use my hands and build stuff. And I'm a sports fanatic. So it was a natural progression to want to go into orthopedics.
Yeah. I mean, we get that stereotype of being the jocks and this and that, but it's such a common thread for most of us. We either played high school or college sports or some, maybe even professionally, but you know, it's, I couldn't think of a better job in the world. Two of my three sons are telling me they want to be orthopedic surgeons. I try to tell them, I think it's a different world today, being a physician. They're young. I mean, I've got a 13-year-old. He's our oldest, then 11 and 9. So the younger two are saying, we want to be like Dad. And maybe it's just that phase of life, right?
Oh, that's great.
But, you know, they come in. They shadow me. Two of them, one's coming this week, but two of the three have been into the office and shadowed me. They've seen injections. They obviously haven't been in surgery because they're so young, but not too far away, I think, before we start getting them in the OR and, you know, exposing them to exactly what Dad does for a living.
Turning them away.
So Frank, you and I do the same.
To work.
What'd you say?
Put those boys to work.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mop that up.
So what about joints? Because you and I share a passion that you and I both do adult reconstruction, which for the lay people out there means, you know, joint replacement. And the primary joints that we focus on are hip and knee replacement. When was there a surgeon, a moment that kind of like, this is what I want to do and focus on?
Yeah, I went into residency thinking, all right, I'm probably going to end up doing sports medicine. And you know, I enjoyed that. But when it got to do the hands-on and actual work of doing the hips and knees, I just fell in love with it. And I had great mentors. Don McCollum was the senior joint replacement surgeon at Duke at the time. And then Tad Vail, I'm sure you've heard of Tad. He was a very big mentor of mine. And I did a rotation at the VA hospital in Asheville, North Carolina. We had another surgeon from Greenville, South Carolina, that was only an hour away, that would come up and help us. And his name is Tom Pace. He was a very big mentor also. And I just loved it. And that's when I decided that's what I wanted to do.
It's funny because I was actually an athletic trainer in undergrad. So I was very much involved in sports, not only playing them, but covering them. Every season I had a sport I was assigned. So when I decided orthopedics, I was like, I'm doing sports. That's it. And then I was, during my residency, I do it. I'm like, this is cool. Then I started doing joints. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, back to my carpentry days. I was like, these are almost immediate results. Now, granted, it's a big operation to recover from, but it's night and day. It's like the bone's broke, now it's fixed. The joint's arthritic, now it's not. And I felt like with sports, and no disrespect to any of our sports colleagues, friends, mentor, whatever it may be, but it's a soft tissue operation for the most part. And I feel like I'm more of a bony guy, although with personalized surgery and alignment and kinematic, all those things that are coming about, and I've been doing KAA for 6 years now, we don't ignore the soft tissues, but it's still, you got to cut the bone in the correct position to make those ligaments, you know, balanced and happy. But, you know, I'm just enamored by the fact that you're part of you're the president of such a large practice. So maybe a tough question to answer, but what are the biggest challenges that you have seen as the president of this organization? And what are the biggest like plus or upsides that you've seen of your so-called supergroup with Emerge Ortho?
Well, I think that's a great question. The challenge wise, it is getting everybody on the same page, but I think we, just by really good communications, we're able to achieve that. And you know, everyone's ultimate goal is the same, to remain independent and to have a thriving practice. When challenges do occur, the whole key is just getting everybody's opinion on what to do from that and getting everybody on board. I mean, the challenges are great for any independent practice, the internal challenges, the challenges to our bottom line, to our revenue, as well as our expenses. Then the outside challenges, the competition from the hospital systems, private equity. Those are all challenges for all practices. I think where we gain our strength is in Emerge is just having a real strong executive committee where everyone voices their opinion, everyone respects each other's opinion. And 9 out of 10 times when we vote on something and have aired everything out, it's a unanimous vote. If we didn't have communication, if people didn't check their egos at the door, we wouldn't be able to achieve everything we've been achieving.
So I guess, and one of the things, I don't even know if you know about this, but something that came up today was that there is it's very small. It's a insurance company that's, doing this sort of, the hybrid, Medicare Advantage plans. And it's a small group that is out of Florida that is in like 13 or 14 states. And they've come into Pennsylvania and they came into the practice today to, kind of have a conversation about, they're going to start adding members into, the community. And, they kept getting this sort of feedback that for orthopedic needs, orthopedic care, in the Crawford County area, where Dr. Molly operates for total joints, that this was kind of the place that the community has, chosen to be their center of excellence. And so, they wanted to kind of sit down and sort of have this conversation of, give me your 30,000 foot view and let us tell you a little bit about us. And, you know, those beginning conversations, right, where, you know, a lot of the big payers are already, you know, have been established for, you know, as long as we can remember, just in terms of, you know, reimbursements and fee schedules and all those sort of things. So for your practice and being as massive as it is, but still private. So, you know, I'm assuming at this point they have to come to you because the options become limited because of just the footprint that you have. Do you have a team of people that, you know, in addition to obviously from the physician side, but like an administration side that take care of like insurance contracting, renewals, like negotiating fee schedules, all that sort of stuff? What does that look like?
Yeah, so the way we have it structured is we have a shared virtual business office that everyone, all the regions participate in. And okay. They do all the day-to-day coding and billing, mm-hmm. Do all the prior approvals, all of the business functions. Our C-suite, we have a CEO, phenomenal, Allison Farmer. She has been our CEO for 3.5 years, just does a fantastic job. We have a CFO. We recently, in the past year, got a chief information officer to deal with all of the IT, which is a massive challenge.
Yeah.
Chief counsel. So those are all in the C-suite. We do have a director of payer relations and a payer relations committee that has physicians and admin on. And the director of payer relations goes to all of the, you know, the big commercial insurance companies and does all that stuff. And we're actually very, very active in commercial bundles and starting to get involved in trying to do some Medicare Advantage bundles for mostly the joint procedures, and starting to do it starting to explore it for spine and some other things too.
Are you guys owning the bundles and managing the bundles, the practice?
For the commercial, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So a little background on that. In Greensboro, before we joined the merge, the community got together and the fellowship trained joint surgeons started an outpatient joint program, went to the commercial insurance companies directly and started doing outpatient joints there. And recently, coming out of BPCI, we have a pretty vibrant ACO and have negotiated what we call shadow bundles, where we're doing bundles with the ACO and doing shared savings on that. But the commercial bundles throughout all of Emerge are mostly 90-day bundles, some same-day surgery bundles, but we own them. Emerge owns them and does all the downstream payments from there. And at the end, keeps the reward.
Nice.
Smart.
So we're getting very... looking at the future, we're seeing that.
Yeah.
And you see the same thing. The reimbursement for fee-for-service, we're just getting crushed on that. So we're trying to get more and more into value-based care. And that's where our critical mass of having such a large practice really helps us a lot.
I would imagine.
It gets us to the table for the with the insurance companies for the bundle.
Oh, your leverage, right, is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, Ortho Carolina, which is the other large practice, we formed a CIN, a clinically integrated network with them. And we're looking at doing population health for MSK care. We're negotiating that with a lot of the private insurers, as well as the Medicare Advantage plans and even some direct-to-employer stuff.
That's awesome. So one of my big questions that I always like to ask people that are in private practice, and what was it for you that was like, all right, we talked about ortho, we talked about medicine, but like why private practice for you? And if you were talking to a young surgeon coming out of residency or fellowship now and had to give your 2-minute, this is why you should choose private practice. Because quite frankly, you and I probably agree on this. It's not for everybody, right? There's quite a few physicians that I know that I would be like, no, I think you're actually better in an employed position. Yeah. And not saying it's a 9-to-5, but you don't have to worry about the administrative burdens, the business things, the staff issues. But what would your sales pitch be, and what attracted you to private practice? Because you've been in private practice your whole career, correct?
Yeah, 26 and a half years, almost 27 years. Wow.
So
yeah. I think, you know, the main reason why a lot of people go into medicine is the ability to stay independent and be your own boss. And I think the key, if you want to have autonomy over your career, private practice is the only way at this point to do it. If you join a hospital, your autonomy's gone. You're basically an employee your entire career, or as long as you stay with the hospital. If you have any kind of, you know, entrepreneurial tendency, private practice is really also the only way to expand upon that. You'll have, you know, if you want to go into private practice, you'll have the opportunity to participate in ancillaries, not just your practice. If you are an employee, you won't have that opportunity. So even though you may start out with a higher salary, higher income, if you're an employee of a hospital system, when you get 3 to 5 years into it, you're going to do better in private practice than you are in that other situation. And there's no guarantee you're going to be able to maintain your level of income as an employee. There's always that possibility that they're going to start trimming back on your.
I think it's almost inevitable, right? It's like cooking a frog. Like you turn that temp up just a little bit every year, and before you know it, you're cooked. They have those conversations, because I did it for 2 years. I was private practice my first year. Second and third years of practice were employed. Worst 2 years of my professional career. And within a week, I knew it wasn't for me. And then, but I was tempted. I was tempted because I was making nothing as a private practice guy, and went back to making nothing, but I was much happier because of the autonomy and ability for me to have that entrepreneurial freedom.
Right. Yeah, because there's always the more potential. Even though your day-to-day practice, your fee for service is not going up, anything is more and more downward pressure on that. But there's always that potential with ancillaries and getting into value-based stuff and ownership of ASCs. You have much greater potential in private practice, and that's not going away. I mean, what we're seeing now is some of the hospitals are actually wanted to divest from their employed surgeons because they're not as profitable as they thought they were going to be. Yeah. And, with the ability now in North Carolina to own ASCs, some of these people are wanting to get out and get into private practice. The problem is if they have non-competes with trying to get out of that hospital, they're not going to be able to get into, stay in the same community.
Yeah, that's relocation written all over it.
I think for me too, as I'm kind of listening to this conversation, it's like, yeah, obviously there's the diminished, autonomy piece to it that you both have kind of alluded to. But, I think the other thing too is it's like there's a loss of like connection with the patient and the service side of things, right? Like, obviously we've, looked up Emerge Ortho and, have kind of the big picture view of it, but it's just like the service piece, right? Like the patient's experience and that sort of thing. And, sometimes when you get into these big health systems that, the physicians don't have any real control over that. Right.
Well, they're being told you got to see X amount of patients per day. And then each year it goes up by 5 or 10 per clinic.
And it's challenging for them too, but it really is. It's, the experience I think is at the end of the day, just like anything, why do you shop where you shop? Why do you buy the cars who you buy them from? Why do you get the suits where you all that sort of stuff is, you can get that from wherever you want, but you go to a certain place, to a certain person, to an individual because of the experience that you have. And I feel like, Dr. Luzit, what you guys at Emerge Ortho and your practice before that, before it became a part of this, massive conglomerate, and what, Dr. Molly and Whole Health, what they're doing is, it's that concept of that service and that experience, right? And so all of the other benefits that you get from an individual, as the surgeon, from the entrepreneurship and, the, autonomy to have, those different, economical advantages of being able to do different things, with different models, that's all good. But I think from the patient allure is the service and the experience that you have, which ultimately I think healthcare has sort of been something that has been maybe a little bit of a sense of entitlement for a lot of people. And they just feel like, you know, I have this little card that has these XYZ numbers on it, and I should be able to go anywhere, and it should be the same. But it's not. It's not the same. And you know, you need to be, you know, educated as a consumer too of where you're going and why you're going there. And I think that that's where the private practice, you know, sort of arena has a significant advantage.
No, you're right. I mean, you have to have that personal touch. I mean, you have to. I remember going through med school. One of the professors said the key to success in medicine is the three A's: ability, availability, and affability. So you have to, you know, someone needs to see it. Doesn't matter what time it is, where it is. You better be, if you want to be successful, you better see them. And then you better treat them right, because if you don't, especially nowadays, and you start getting bad reviews, then there goes your practice. And it's so important in private practice to be good to your patients and treat them right. Yeah, if you want to stay busy and stay successful in an institution, it a lot of people are coming there for the institution and not so much for the individual. So there is a very big difference between the two.
Isn't that so true?
It's,
I mean, compared here in this area, it's, you don't go to an institution. You're going to the surgeon based upon your neighbors and your family friends and that have had good results with this particular surgeon. That's easily, by far and away, the biggest referral source that I have is just word of mouth. And yeah. as my parents taught me at a very young age, is like, you take very good care of people,
they'll take good care of you
in return. Yeah. So,
very true words. No words truer in what we do.
Yeah. So, again, not going back on the challenges side of things, but like, you've got all these physicians that, in their minds, have maybe a certain implant that they think is the best or a certain technique that is the best. Mm-hmm. So how do you, because for us, it's pretty simple. Myself and my total joint colleague, we do the same procedures, we do them the same ways, and we use the same implants. But that's two versus 120. How do you, and we're in a very small city versus a state. So Do you guys have like a single vendor system? How do you do your marketing so that people aren't getting offended? Like, so-and-so doesn't answer approach, so-and-so doesn't. How does that work?
Well, so it's so regional though, because we're being all the way across the state. We have our statewide marketing, but the regions also will, you know, through LinkedIn or other social media outlets will highlight some of the things they're doing, but just within that region. And it really doesn't cross over because since we're so spread out and so far apart, the areas where someone may go to one region or another are very limited. So we're really not competing with each other where we have to say, well, we do it better here or they do it better out on the coast. You know, as far as like implants and everything, that's also regional and facility based. Like for our ASC in Greensboro, we have we said, hey, all right, here's the price we're going to pay for hips, here's the price we're going to pay for knees. All are welcome to come in at those prices. If you don't want to come in at those prices, then you can't be in the facility. And that's true for the other ASCs within the state.
Do you guys share your EMR system? Because I would think that would be one of the huge advantages of like the super group, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, major cost savings for that. So one other exciting thing that we've become part of through Merge this past year, I don't know if you've heard of it, Pelto.
Yeah.
Physician-empowered leadership of transformational organizations. It was us, Ortho Indy, and Proliance out in Washington.
Patel.
So three really large groups, we got together and we said, all right, we need to have an alternative landing site for the small to mid-sized groups that feel like they can't do it on their own anymore. We need to be able to help them out. Ortho Forum's great. We're all part of Ortho Forum. That's for the larger groups. And that's also an avenue to really help out with the logistics of your group and stay independent. But we got together and we said, all right, let's take our best practices of these three big practices, and we can learn from each other. We can improve our efficiencies in three groups, but we could also, you know, get out there and make an offering for other large groups or even the small to medium sized groups to come in and you know, we could share these back office functions. And that is, you know, in a year and a half that since we've been together, that's been a great transition in that we've gotten vendors to come in and give contracts, great contracts for different types of back office functions. And we've made those available for others to come in and join. And we just had two other medium-sized groups join, and we have about five or six other groups that are looking to come in and take advantage of this. And we leverage in our size to get better deals on these and to just share these best practices. That's been really good.
Yeah,
that's in its infancy, but it's growing pretty nicely.
I mean,
but in independent practice, you have to do things like this in order to try and level off the playing field.
But it's kind of fun, isn't it? Like for me,
it's so much fun.
As frustrating as it may be from time to time, and let's be honest, we all have been there where we go through our slow periods or our struggles. But those are the times where you probably learn the most. It's not when you're making hay and everything's going great. It's those moments of challenge, maybe some indecisiveness. You've met an obstacle. There's a great book that my business partner shared with me. It's called The Obstacle is the Way. I don't know if you've ever heard of that book. It's a wonderful book. It's going to be our next book for our leadership team. And it's just talking about when life presents obstacles, a lot of people will, there's a stone in the road. I'm going to go around. I'm going to find another way. And you know, the prophecy was like five people came, they went around. The one guy that was like, no, I'm going to try to, when he moved it, he found, you know, just gold buried underneath it. So it's the obstacle truly is the way. And private practice, I feel like, has a ton of obstacles right now, but there's so much upside. So if I had to give you kind of like the David Letterman, red carpet, healthcare solutions, top five main areas to focus on for success in private practice, what would they be? Let's start with number five, to the most important.
Okay. So I think that I think coalition with like-minded people. So if it means, if you have a large group, everyone getting on the same page. If you're in a smaller group, then, getting into arrangements with other groups and just learning from each other. I think that's extremely important. That may be actually number one or two.
That's okay. We can shift them around. Yeah. Just list them. And then as you're talking, you can always shift them up or down.
Yeah. Yeah. I think thinking outside the box and realizing that, in our current reimbursement environment with, Medicare reimbursement going down a ridiculous amount and continuing to go down and the commercials following that, we've got to think outside the box about alternative streams of revenue, whether that be through ancillaries or through getting into value-based care. That's important. Three, I think, is having a very strong governance in your practice from top down to bottom, getting everybody involved. You have to have all hands on deck to survive and to come up with new ideas, come up with new ways to do things, and everyone has to have an open mind to adapt and bring in new ideas and do new things in order to keep going. That may be five. I think the other ones may be one and two. Relationships with outside entities are extremely important. Even though you're competing with the hospital, I think you have to have a good relationship with your local hospital. Through co-management agreements, even some joint, consideration of joint ventures for ASCs and imaging centers. You got to keep that relationship open because, with what we do, even if we get up to 85-90% of outpatient stuff, we still need our hospital. And you don't want to be in such a competitive mode where there's animosity between the two. So you got to have the outside relations. And I think advocacy is also very important. Each group should, if they're large enough, should have their own PAC, and everyone should contribute to the PAC and have a voice locally, which are state and local governments, and then also use the academy, use, if you're a member of OrthoForum, use those for the more national issues. But if we're not at the table and we don't have a voice in things, we're going to get crushed.
That's a great five.
Yeah, I love it. And I mean, one of the things you said right before your five was, you know, best practices. And that's something that really has been resonating with me from the inception of this podcast to just my experiences in the med device world and meeting, you know, doc folks like yourself and Dr. Molly, is like, you know, there are groups out there and there are individuals out there who, you know, aren't necessarily hoarding, you know, the secret sauces to themselves, right? And want to be, you know, leaders in, catalysts in, you know, their respective, you know, marketplaces and, you know, arenas of kind of, you know, whatever it is that they do, to be able to share this with the masses and collaborate. And, you know, this isn't just for me, it's for everybody else, right? It's for the physician of the future. It's for the you 26 years ago, Dr. Luzio. It's for you, you know, Dr. Molly back in Michigan. It's for, you know, the guys that are starting and have to go through those trials and tribulations. And it's like, there's an easier way, right? And, you know, here's the path. And I'm not trying to hand it to you, but, you know, here are the experiences that we've had. And I think that's the whole concept of this podcast, is to provide this content to inspire others to have the conversation that no one else is having or aren't having publicly, to just say like, hey, there's a way. People are doing it. And by the way, here are the people and here's the story. And it wasn't easy. And yeah, there are mountains to climb and there are, you know, holes to, you know, burrow through and fences to get under, but it can be done. And, you know, and
this private practice is not dead. And I hate when I hear that. And quite frankly, I think the people that are saying that are kind of hoping and wishing it would be dead, because they're maybe afraid of that pendulum swing that's naturally going to come back, because it has gone so far one direction. But as you mentioned, there's guys and girls that are employed physicians with hospitals that are disgruntled, disappointed. You know, they've been given the bait and switch, and maybe their compensation's been compromised, or they just don't like to be told what to do anymore. They don't like to be told how to practice medicine by somebody that doesn't know how to practice medicine. And that pendulum is going to start to swing back. And I feel like it already is.
It's starting to. And I mean, if you look at the competition for independent practices, it's hospitals and it's private equity. Private equity had their worst year in 2023, and 2024 has not been much better as far as acquisition of new practices, or that the second bite phenomenon of selling their initial investment to a larger private equity group. They're getting so much more scrutiny at the state and national level. So it looked a few years ago that was going to be one of the bigger threats to independent practice, but I think that's kind of dying down and going by the wayside. And like I said, the employed situation with the hospitals are a lot of them are realizing that it's not as profitable as they thought it would be. And the competition with the private groups is probably not the way to go, that the private groups are much more flexible, especially going towards value-based care, because we can provide everything at such lower cost. And a lot of them don't have ASCs. We have ASCs, and ASCs are definitely the way to go in the future for value-based stuff. I mean, if you look at the differences, gosh, to go to a hospital or a hospital-based physician, it's costing you 30% more just for office visits and for any procedure and any imaging modality. They can't compete with that with us, because you know, we are the lower cost, which means higher value.
Now, you mentioned doing some bundles and things like that. Do you have much in the way of self-insured companies, big organizations down in your area that are looking for centers of excellence to kind of collaborate and partner with?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you asked about that. We're not seeing it as much in our state, but through the Ortho Forum, they're creating this Ortho Forum Value Network, where all the Ortho Forum groups are part of it, and they're going directly to employers and some of the nationwide employers that are throughout the country, and just making the offering for the direct to employer product. So this is just starting up now, and I think that's going to have great potential, not only for bundles, but just for just regular orthopedic care. Just having transparency in pricing is what the employers want.
Yeah, smart.
As well as 24/7 access. So each of these groups that are participating are going to have a commitment to having 24/7 access, whether it be through your own practice or through a secondary company that will provide that.
Well, particularly with, I mean, a lot of these big companies that are, you know, self-funded, sure, they have someone who, you know, is administrator of the plan, but I mean, that transparency is key, right? I mean, understanding what exactly it is you're paying for, because that's exactly what's happening, right? I mean, they're paying for it. And
yeah, they're getting crushed on MSK. I mean, the average, I think,
yeah,
for the self-employed, they are spending 25 to 30% of their spend is on MSK.
Wow.
And we've got to take the bull by the horns on this, because there are other groups, Hinge, Sword, these PT-based groups that are going directly to the employers and saying they can do it at a much lower price. And if that's the case, then we end up essentially becoming vendors for them. So orthopedic surgeons have to grab the bull by the horns and be transparent and go directly to these employers and say we could do it better and much more cost effective. If not, we're gonna get our heads handed to us.
It's smart though. And I think, I mean, the model to me is genius. I mean, the bundles, I mean, in itself, I mean, that's kind of also been a theme of the conversation, is like, it makes so much sense, right? Who better to manage a bundle payment than, you know, the orthopedic practice or the surgeon that's responsible mm-hmm. for the procedure? You know, you're going to give us X, let us manage what that profitability looks like and what we see is best for the patient, as opposed to all of these itemized things. And you got to go to this vendor for this and this vendor for that. It's like, we just need to kind of collectively get together and figure out, you know, what's entailed in that, right? So whether it's optimization, the surgery itself, DME items that are involved in that, physical therapy, all of that stuff. I mean, can that bundle that you're talking about, I mean, is, for me, it makes so much more sense for the surgeon practice to manage that piece of it. And, you know, with the ASCs and all the other relationships and how the private practice model is set up, it makes a ton of sense. And I think not only will the insurance companies win and the payers win, but the physician practices, the ASCs, all the partnerships that they have in those realms, everybody wins. And it just seems like, you know, the pendulum is starting to trend that way, I think, because of, quite honestly, the over expenditure, but the waste of the funds. It's like there's all
for
this
me
money
to provide
healthcare spent.
For my employees. The premiums go up every day, the deductibles go up every year. It's just getting absurd, and the coverage in the networks get narrower and worse. So right. It's like paying more for less.
We on a 90-day bundle, we're saving 40% compared to what it was before we started doing the bundle
programs. Wow.
And most importantly, it's a huge win for the patients, because all these patients also have case managers. So it's essentially a concierge service for the patients. They have someone that they, because we want to keep them out of the ERs, because we're responsible for any,
amen,
any complications. So we want to make sure they get a great experience. And the satisfaction rate of these patients is anywhere from 98 to 100%. Awesome. They love the experience. They're paying less. It's a win for them, and it's a huge win for the practices.
So the majority of this conversation has been on private practice, which is awesome. It's also been on the business of private practice, right? Which that is never taught in medical school. That is never taught in residency. That is never taught, other than just through observation. I never got a lecture on any of this stuff in any of my levels of education of residency, fellowship, any of that. It's been on-the-job training. So I guess other words of wisdom, would you recommend that young physicians get an MBA if they want to be in private practice? Listen to podcasts. What would your suggestions be? Because I had kind of learned the hard way. I'm sure that you learned through 26 years of grinding.
I don't think it's necessary to get an MBA. I think that do there need to be a few people in the practice that have them? Yes. But I think the key is mentoring. So we've created a mentoring program for the young physicians coming in. We have a leadership mentoring program where they get to participate on the board. And it's a 2-year stint. They get to go to all the board meetings. They have to be involved in a statewide initiative. And they just learn about leadership and about how the practice is run. And you know, so we've had that in place for, I think, 3 years now. Two of the first five are now on the board. Two others of the first five are now on their regional executive committees. So something like that, where you're teaching people from the start how the business is run and teaching them about leadership, I think is crucial for small practice, large practice, any practice.
But you're getting them in the trenches, like you said, a mentoring program. So they're part of those conversations. They're at that table having those tough conversations about the business side of medicine. And everybody, that's the thing that is, patients don't think about that, and they don't want to hear about that. They want their doctor to just be a doctor, but they don't realize that, like, there is a huge financial crisis within the healthcare industry, like bigger than anything else in this country, with physicians that are unhappy, physicians that are killing themselves at a higher rate than any other profession in the United States. And the staggering stat that I quote all the time is 28.2% of physician suicides are orthopedic surgeons. It's unbelievable. It's almost a third, right? So how do we get past that, right? People are not going into medicine at the same rate as people are needing. I'm just going to use joint replacements. You see the numbers. By 2030, our numbers are exploding with joints that are going to need to be done, and we're going to need to almost triple our volume. That's not possible for me to triple my volume, nor is it probably possible for you to triple your volume.
No, absolutely. No way.
I'm not Charlie DeCook. I'm not doing 12 by 12. I love Charlie. I'm super impressed, but man, that's not what I'm doing. And I don't think my family wants me to do that either. So there's got to be solutions.
You got to work. The whole key to survival is actually not working harder and doing it. It's working smarter.
Yeah.
We'll have to learn how to work smarter. I think we're seeing burnout rates and stuff. One of the hugest causes of physician burnout is lack of autonomy. And that's where another huge advantage of private practice. That's the only setting where you're still autonomous. And I think we're seeing more burnout in the employed physicians, and in hospital settings and in areas where they're not in control of their day-to-day practices. Sure, we need to, the programs need to train more orthopedic surgeons. Our field is growing so much, and it's difficult. A lot of people don't want to go into joints anymore because of the reimbursement issues. But that's where the biggest need is.
And it's funny because a decade ago, everybody wanted to go into joints, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, I
think though, as we go to value based stuff, though, it's probably the best subspecialty to be in.
Yeah,
I think too. I mean, I guess for me, just kind of my two cents on like the solution piece of it. I mean, I think you guys are doing it, and I think, you know, I'll call it your empowered program, but you know, these individuals that get to participate in board conversations and, you know, and kind of get that more advanced or, you know, exposure is sort of like, you know, I think we all know that it takes a special person to want to get to that place and have those conversations. That's not something that can be taught. That's not something that's learned. Those people either have that tenacity and have that eagerness and willingness and discipline and sense of urgency, or they don't. Right, regardless of whatever the career path is, those people either they do or they don't. And so if you're fortunate enough to get some of those people into the mix and can kind of, you know, court them and, you know, hopefully, you know, give them that exposure to get them to that place, you know, that there to me is sort of the answer, right? Like kind of passing the baton, but, you know, helping to kind of cultivate the next generation of of talent, of, you know, surgeons, of, you know, whatever it is. And it's like, that's the next step, because it you know, if the wizard, you know, he holds the secrets, it lives and dies with him. And if there's, you know, not people teaching it in, you know, the programs and schools, which I think you both have kind of alluded to, there wasn't like a business model where it was like, hey, if you want to stay in private practice first, you know, and I get it, the world was different back then than it is now. But I think what, you know, you're doing is the step, is it's the direction that it needs to go, because these sort of conversations pique the interest of people that are going, oh, you know what, I was thinking about doing this, but this sounds very intriguing to me, and I think that I want to do this. And yeah, it's not easy. And if it was easy, everyone would do it, right? I mean, that's probably the old adage that my dad would tell me when I was growing up, right? If it was easy, everyone would do it. And it's not easy, and everyone doesn't do it. But when you can find, you know, that select group of people that are willing to put in the work and the effort and, you know, go through that, like you guys have alluded to during the conversation, that first few years of, you know, I don't know, I didn't make as much as that hospital said I was going to make,
right? You got to sacrifice and grind for
a bit. You got to grind and, you know, and you have to learn and you have to be humble and you have to understand that, you know, there's something to be, you know, something to be learned here. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, there's not a blueprint to that, but I think that, you know, those people, you know, either are or aren't. And I don't know, Doc, if that's been your experience from, you know, the five individuals that you've alluded to with, you know, sort of that program that you have with those guys taking or gals taking those next steps. But I mean, is that something you've experienced?
Oh, personally?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, as far as like me getting into leadership or just from what I've seen from
people? Just, I mean, I guess both, right? From you getting into leadership and then, you know, from the folks that you're bringing in to leadership now. I mean, is that something that, you know, you believe is something that inherently those people have all of those qualities, or is it something that you're, you know, cultivating and teaching, or what does that look like?
Well, first of all, I think the people that go into private practice are more likely to do it. These are people that have the initiative, yeah, that are willing to take risk and want to be, they want to control the narrative instead of having the narrative driven to them. So it's a little easier to find people that are interested in leadership in private practice. But, you know, even in private practice, 90% of the work is done by 15 or 20% of the people. And
we talked about that earlier.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah.
And there are going to be people that don't want to do it, that just want to, you know,
they think they're private practice, right? Yeah. And they are private practice, but they're
reap
not
the benefits.
And they'll, you know,
it's the 80-20 principle.
They'll be happy going about the day-to-day business as long as things are going well. But as soon as something doesn't go well, then you're going to hear from them. But I think, like I said, far more likely to get people involved in leadership. And we felt it was a critical part of our practice. Like you said, it's not just about today, but it's about the future. And you have to create a leadership pipeline in order to continue your practice and all the things you've done now to keep it afloat and to prepare for the future. You've got to have those people ready to come in and take control of the leadership, because, you know, I'm in my late 50s now. I'm probably going to practice 8 or 9 more years. A lot of our board is similar age. We're not going to be around forever. We've got to train that next generation to come in and pass the baton to them and have them. Our executive committee, look, it's not just about today. We've got to create a legacy to have this practice keep going 15, 20, 30 years into the future. And we've got to make it better for the people that are coming on board now and give them the opportunity to take the torch from us and become leaders and continue this thing.
Well, I mean, that is the goal. For you, that is the goal for this podcast. That is the goal for me with my practice, is creating that legacy, creating that sense of autonomy, independence, best practices. Because at the end of the day, our patients, that's always been my number one focus, is that patient experience. Obviously, I want my employees to have a good experience and an enjoyable environment to work, and a place that they're proud to go work at. And at the end of the day, the physicians, right? You got to be happy doing what you're doing. You got to feel invigorated. I mean, Sundays roll around when most people are dreading going to work on Mondays. I'm excited. So, because I get to go help people. I get to do what I love, my passion life. So I just want to thank you for your time, Dr. Aluzio. I mean, this has been an incredible, incredible, probably one of my favorite of the red carpet podcasts that we've had, just because you and I think, share not only just our day-to-day jobs, what we do, but you're a leader. I'm a leader of my practice. And to hear somebody else, like, you have literally reinvigorated me in a time where I've been struggling a little bit. And it's just been kind of like that little jolt of energy to, like, all right, keep going, because this is the way, and we're doing good things. So I want to personally thank you for your time, for your candor. I guess if I had one last question, it would be like kind of along the same lines as my top five, but just like, here's your 30-second to 1-minute outro of, all right, young ladies and gentlemen, if you're coming out and you're considering private practice, like, what has been the best part of it for you over the past 26 years? And what would you cherish the most and not want to give up?
I think the ability to create relationships with the patients. In private practice, it's a unique opportunity to really bond with your patients, and you're given them your all, and in return, not only do you see the improvements they have from the treatment we give, but just the relationships you build with them. And over 26 years, you don't only see them, you see their family members. You go out in the community and you see people every time you get no anonymity. Every time you go out, you're seeing people you've operated on. But I think just that opportunity to play a huge role in your community, help people tremendously, and build all these relationships. And you can have a very successful career, both financially and, more importantly, just feel good about yourself and feel good about what you're doing. And I think you have that opportunity to create that impact in private practice. I don't know that you have that opportunity to create such an impact in other settings. And you're in charge of your business. You are going to be as successful as you want. You're going to work as hard as you want. If you don't work hard enough, you're not going to make it. You're going to end up somewhere else. But if your goal coming into medicine was to be your own boss and to make an impact on people, then this is the way to do it.
Amen. Love it. Any final questions from you?
No, I appreciate, the conversation. I appreciate the honesty and kind of the glimpse into, Emerge Ortho and this massive entity. And I think that the conversation, the feedback, the content, all the stuff that we're kind of, initially when Dr. Molly's like, hey, you know what we should do? We should have a podcast. I'm like, that's what we need.
Yeah. And my second podcast.
I don't regret it, because I thoroughly enjoy these conversations. And Dr. Luzio, I appreciate your time and, just the conversation. And I know it takes a lot to away from the families and work. And I know how hard you guys work. And I know the long days and, the conferences and the speaking engagements. And I get it. And I just appreciate the time that you
take
out.
Board meetings, all that.
I appreciate it. And I hope that, the viewers, and I hope there's a resident or a fellow or somebody watching that sees this and, has some tidbits and, is inspired by the conversation, because that is the whole point of this. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Guys, thank you, both of you. This was great. I mean, this is my passion. I mean, taking great care of patients, doing what we do on a day-to-day basis, but keeping the hope alive, keeping independent practice alive, and allowing others coming out and starting their practices to be able to do what we've done. And I mean, this podcast is great. What you guys are doing is so helpful. And I could sit here and talk for 3 or 4 more hours.
Same. I hear my wife upstairs like beating her foot, and the dogs are like, and the boys are getting home from their football and baseball. But,
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, I'd be glad to come back anytime and talk.
Oh, we're gonna.
There's gonna be a part two.
There'll be a sequel to this for sure. Yes. I would be remiss if I didn't thank kind of our guy that suggested you as a guest, and that's Marty Nichols. So Marty said, hey, you've got to get, you know, Emerge Ortho and especially you on to kind of speak about this, Dr. Aluzio. And, you know, we struggled connecting, getting a date down. We had to reschedule a couple times, but thank you for your patience with that, because quite honestly, this has been one of my favorite ones that we've done so far. You're definitely coming back for part two. And, you know, I would just ask that maybe you share this with your friends, your colleagues, because they're going to be like-minded. They're going to be struggling at a certain point and being like, am I doing good? Am I helping? Am I making a difference? And I think just your conversation that you had with us is just like reinvigorated. Not that I didn't have the drive or the hunger, because I always have that, but like, it's good. It's very positive. And I hope that the younger physicians out there are listening and looking forward to this. And as we always say, comments, likes, suggestions, subscribe. If you have anybody you want to hear or see on the show, let us know.
And so right here, not that obviously you need more exposure because the footprint's so big, but Emerge Ortho. So
yeah, Jay can put that there for
Jay
you guys.
Jay can put this right here so that, you know, people can see it, go check it out. They can count all of the headshots.
The great things that you guys are doing. Like, we were scrolling down through your physicians, and I'm like I was getting like trigger thumb because I was scrolling.
And I was like, how many? I can't count all of the doctors. This is incredible.
Well, I tell you, it would not be successful if we didn't have 160 dedicated physicians that their goal on a daily basis is to take good care of people and do what's best for their patients. Our size doesn't matter. It's just the day-to-day commitment to patient care that has made us so successful.
I applaud you guys. 160 physicians that are all bought in to me. You know, we were talking about challenges. You know,
that's like a bigger accomplishment than putting like a man on the moon to me. Like getting 160 physicians.
That's huge. No, it's incredible. It's amazing. And you know. And even through this, I mean, I've learned so much about, you know, you guys in the practice and, you know, that area. And I've got a very good friend and kind of a similar world that we live in that lives in Raleigh. That was just, we went to college together at Gannon, and he was just up here, Derek, not that long ago. And I'm just like, I can't wait to tell him tomorrow. I'm like, Emerge Ortho, man, if you're not there, you need to figure it out. So
before we sign off, I just want to do one little fun thing, because you asked me some personal questions. Who are you personally? What do you like to do with your downtime when you're not leading a huge orthopedic group and helping a lot of patients with hip and knee problems?
I told you I'm a sports fanatic, but I'm also an exercise fanatic. So I get up at 4:30 every morning to get to the gym at 5 to do Orange Theory 5 days a week. And work throughout the day, do the meetings at night. And, you know, fun time. My family is, you know, that's my number one priority. My most cherished thing. I've got 4 kids, wife of 33 years, and just doing stuff with them. And
how old are your kids? How old are your kids?
Oh, so my oldest, she's 31, and then I've got 30, 28, and 26. So 2 of them are following me. They're in med school now. They're entering their third year of med school. I don't think they're going to do orthopedics. I have one in veterinary school and one that is applying to PA school.
Very smart. Where's the vet school?
They're in Spartanburg, South Carolina, DO program in Spartanburg, South Carolina, VCOM.
Oh, cool.
They're entering their third year. And,
my wife's cousin just finished Ohio State, and he's in Missouri of all places. I don't know why, but that's where he ended up. It's an interesting business. So, yeah.
Well, thank you again. We'll obviously reach out to you to kind of let you know when this is going to land. But I want to thank all of our viewers for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marty Nichols, for this great, great suggestion. And Frank, I hope to meet you sometime soon in person so that we can, you know, chat and shake hands.
Are you going to be at AUKUS this year?
I will be. Yeah.
All right. Let's plan on trying to get together.
Let's connect.
Absolutely.
All right, everybody. So have a great night. Stay tuned. We're coming up in a couple weeks with another episode. So have a great night.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Take care.
a disclaimer, this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professional from any such conditions.